Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is, what day is it? Oh, it's Monday, October 18th, 2021. Also known as my birthday eve. It's going to be the big 3-8 tomorrow on October 19th. Weird. And I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. That's my name. This week, we have a great episode for you. I had the opportunity to talk to an incredibly insightful and brilliant neurologist. But before we dive into the very specific and interesting topic, I do want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that is because I rely so heavily on the support of listeners just like you. There are so many great listeners who pledge their support at each episode via patreon.com/talknerdy. I can't even thank you all. So instead, I'm going to thank the coolest folks in the solar system, the coolest people on Earth, and of course, a few friends of Talk Nerdy. Yes, those are my cheesy tears on Patreon. So big shout out and thank you to Rob Schreck, Daniel Lang, Mary Neva, Krister Jansen, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, David J. E. Smith, June Sapara, Ulrika Hagman, and Robert Christ. You guys keep this train on the tracks. Okay, let's dive into this week's episode. So I had the opportunity to sit remotely down across the pond, actually, with Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan. Now, she is an Irish neurologist, and she wrote a fascinating book called The Sleeping Beauties and Other Stories of Mystery Illness. And in this book, she really dug deep into this concept, this idea of psychosomatic disorder, psychogenic illness, what might have historically been called conversion disorders, functional neurological illnesses. They're very complicated. There's a lot more than meets the eye. And it's a great book. It's an important book. And I think that we grapple with some interesting concepts. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan. Well, Suzanne, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to be talking, among other things, about your new book, The Sleeping Beauties. I'm really excited to talk about. So you come from neurology, but we're really talking about, neurological issues, but also very psychological issues. And I'm excited to kind of encapsulate those two things together today.
Yeah, I mean, precisely right. I mean, and this is an issue, I think, for medicine. You know, I'm trained as a neurologist, and therefore I'm supposed to only deal with brain diseases and spinal diseases and muscle problems and so forth. But, you know, psychosomatic conditions are incredibly common and they manifest as neurological symptoms very, very commonly. So I think, you know, we neurologists need to get better at it.
We also within psychology have, I think, often struggled. And I come from sort of the psychological side of things. I'm working on my PhD right now in clinical psych, so kind of applied practical psych, although I studied neuroscience for my master's degree, but I've never, you know, worked in medicine. I find that from the DSM side of things, these sort of psychogenic or psychosomatic disorders, sometimes referred to as maybe conversion disorders, or we'll talk about factitious disorders, or now we see a lot in the neurological literature, functional disorders. They all sort of overlap. It's not really a clean boundary between what is coming from outside of us, from inside of us, due to culture, due to kind of a mismatch between the way that we feel in our bodies and the way that we are meant to think that we're supposed to feel. It's a very complicated topic.
Yeah. I think what people really struggle with in this is that they don't realize that, you know, our thoughts and feelings are embodied always. So, you know, there's a kind of a tendency for people to kind of imagine their thoughts as these sort of ethereal things that live inside their brain somewhere, without really realizing that, you know, every single emotional thing that happens to you comes with a bodily change too. And in fact, sometimes the bodily change can be the only thing. And you can tell sort of what kind of personality a person has sometimes from the way they carry their body. You can tell if someone's confident or if they're shy or if someone's having a good day or someone's having a bad day. So we communicate with our bodies how we are feeling all the time. And yet when it comes to illness, I think, you know, a lot of people still have kind of a difficulty accepting how much the body speaks for us.
You're so right. And it's something I notice quite a bit when I'm working. You know, I work with individuals who have cancer. And so I think there the crossover is pretty apparent. But even still, I find that whether somebody has a history of trauma, whether somebody is just trying to make sense of a new diagnosis, or they're dealing with much more severe illness, kind of across the gamut, what I find is that the conversation often in the therapy space comes back to this reality that the psychological and the somatic really cannot be untwined, that absolutely we experience our psychological symptoms, they manifest somatically and vice versa. And so, of course, when it comes to what, you know, you refer to in the book as sort of these like psychogenic illnesses, it becomes even more complicated, because even illness that has a biological, I don't want to say biological cause, but something that we can point to, something we can test with a reagent test, or we can test some sort of neurological exam, it's inextricably linked. It's in your head and your body at the same time.
I mean, I think, you know, it's what's already apparent, and this arises in all conversations about these disorders, is how sort of language and the conceptualization of these disorders fails them, you know, because, you know, everything that happens to us is biological. So, you know, the way we talk about sort of emotional things or psychosomatic things sometimes makes it sound like a disease has a biological change, but a psychosomatic thing doesn't have a biological change, when clearly that's, you know, not true. If somebody has a seizure, as many of my patients do, for more psychosomatic reasons, there are real biological changes happening in their brain to make them have that seizure. And the other thing I would say, you know, where language fails us is, I think, it's a problem with terms like psychogenic. So I kind of, you know, we're constantly changing the labels of these disorders in order to try and get around these problems. But as a neurologist now, we know that when patients come to us with these sorts of disorders, they very often say, I'm not stressed, I'm not distressed, I'm not emotionally upset, so your diagnosis must be wrong. And I think that's because they're actually right. A percentage of these disorders are psychogenic, so a percentage of them are caused by a stress reaction. But actually, another percentage of them is caused by someone just changing the attention they pay to their body for some reason, like an injury or fear of an illness or sort of a disease that they're having difficulty recovering from. So some of these disorders are caused by psychological distress and some are not, but we're kind of classing them all together. So we think, you know, and that's confusing for a patient, because it means if they are diagnosed with psychosomatic disorder, the first question everyone wants to ask comes straight from Freud. And that might be right for a third of the people and wrong for the other sort of two-thirds. So I think that these disorders exist on a continuum. And if we kind of understood that better, it'd be less confusing for people.
I think there's also a real stigma that's carried when you do hear words like psychosomatic or psychogenic, because it almost sounds, at least here in America, and I think probably in the West, and maybe even, you know, to some extent across the globe, there becomes a sort of like victim blaming mentality. Like, what I think a lot of people might take away from the word psychogenic is, oh, they're making it up.
Yeah, and that's the problem, really. I mean, one of the only things that has actually happened with these disorders in the last 100 years has, you know, been how often the name has changed. It's the biggest change in these disorders, because I see people with seizures, and they used to be called hysteria, then they were called conversion disorder, then non-epileptic attacks, psychogenic attacks, functional seizures, dissociative seizures. And what we're doing with all of these different names is we're desperately trying to sort of distance ourselves from all the negative connotations which comes with the older names. And precisely the biggest worry is that, you know, it means I'm mad, it means I'm faking it, it means I'm fragile in some way. I think we need to stop changing the names and start instead changing how people understand this kind of mind-body-society reaction. You know, in writing this book, I met these amazing people called the Miskito people of Nicaragua. I actually met them in Texas, in Port Arthur in Texas. They're indigenous people of Nicaragua. A large number of them live in Port Arthur because it's a sort of there's oil refineries there, I think. And they have a condition and they call it greasy sickness. Now, what greasy sickness is what would be referred to in my patients are these kind of hysterical seizures or psychosomatic seizures. They call them greasy sickness and they attribute them to spirits. Now, the reason I raise it is because their seizures are very like the seizures that my patients get, you know, and that happen in the US very commonly as well. But greasy sickness attracts a community response. So if you get these seizures, the community sort of immediately say, well, this person needs help. And they sort of begin to support the people and they treat them with ritual and they get better. But what happens in the UK and the US is that you get locked away somewhere sort of, you know, behind your own front door so that people don't see you having these seizures and you're referred to a psychologist. So you're sort of isolated from the community by them. And the consequence of that is you don't get better. But the reason it came to my mind at that moment is that the literal translation of greasy sickness is actually crazy sickness. So they actually have a medical disorder called crazy sickness, and they tolerate that name. And the reason they tolerate that name is because they don't consider it to be a stigmatized condition or the fault of the individual, in which case it doesn't matter what they call it. They can call it whatever they want if it isn't considered a judgment. And I think we could learn a little from that. You know, we're constantly trying to find satisfactory labels, whereas I think what we really need to find is a way of conceptualizing psychosomatic disorders that make people understand that they're not the fault of the person affected.
Interesting. So there's sort of an order of events that's happening here, a sort of difficult causal relationship wherein we're so focused on naming it something that hopefully reduces the stigma that we're not actually talking much about reducing the stigma around it as a cultural phenomenon. We think that somehow if we just fix the name, that all of the cultural baggage will just follow. But unfortunately, it takes a lot more education and a lot more public discourse than just changing the name. Because the truth is, I bet anybody listening to the show is actually maybe a little bit lost about all these different words like, you know, conversion disorder and functional neurological syndrome and hysterical seizures. And they're like, what are you guys even talking about?
Yeah, maybe I should explain that better. I mean, these are all words that are used sort of to label similar related things. We're really talking about the way that the body can produce real physical symptoms. And I emphasize the word real here because it's very important. I'm talking about something that's not faked, real physical symptoms that are produced because of psychological or behavioral reasons.
And so as opposed to what we might have heard referred to as malingering or factitious disorder, these labels that we use for somebody who is, quote, faking something for maybe financial gain or to get attention or, you know, for a myriad, there could be real psychological harm happening, but the symptoms themselves are not real. We're talking about real symptoms.
Yeah, and that's really important because, you know, every single person who has psychosomatic disorder, when you give them their diagnosis, their biggest fear is that people will think they're faking their seizures. And that fear is so legitimate because they go into sort of, you know, emergency departments and or they sort of tell their diagnosis to their neighbor, for example, and people are constantly treating them as if their illness was less important because it has a social cause. People are suspicious of them. Now, I've been a medical doctor for over 30 years, and I can assure you that people who fake illness are by far the rarest type. And you can usually spot them when they come to my clinic with seizures that they are deliberately faking. And the way I can spot them is when I admit them to hospital to see the seizures, they don't have them. Because they don't want me to see them. They know they're faking them, you know, so they sort of, and they come for one test. And if I say, well, you didn't have a seizure, so I want you to come back and come into hospital a second time so I can see the seizures, you know, they're resistant to that repeated testing because, you know, they know what's going on. But what happens to people who have psychosomatic disorders is that when the first scan is normal, they are begging for the next scan. And they have their seizures in front of me in my office, in the sort of hospital ward where there's a lot of experienced staff. And that really speaks to how desperate they are for an answer. That's very much not the behavior of someone who's faking an illness. And for those who are still skeptical, we can now do functional brain imaging, where we say to somebody, you know, one person who's perfectly healthy, pretend to be paralyzed, and then somebody else who has a psychosomatic paralysis. And we look at how their brains react in those two different groups of people, and we can see that their brain reactions are completely different. So for anyone who's still a little skeptical, these things are absolutely measurable now with functional imaging. So malingering is actually quite rare, and psychosomatic conditions are very common.
So we've sort of identified the difference between malingering or faking it and a psychosomatic condition. But what then is the difference between a psychosomatic condition and a, let's say, neurotypical or classic seizure disorder?
So you mean like an epileptic seizure disorder, is that what you mean? So what happens in an epileptic seizure disorder is that person gets, for any number of, you know, loads of reasons, head injuries, genetic problems, people get unwanted electrical discharges in the brain. So obviously all our brains are working through electrical activity. If you get some unstable cells that produce big bursts of synchronous electrical activity, that produces what most people understand as an epileptic seizure, and that can manifest in lots of different ways. But if you test the brains of people who are having these things, we now call them dissociative seizures. They have a psychosomatic cause. They used to be called hysteria. The electrical activity of the people in having those sort of seizures is completely normal. Now, what stops them from, but they're still unconscious. So we have to sort of, you know, one of the biggest difficulties with these disorders is try to explain to somebody, well, how can this person be unconscious if their brain waves say they're not unconscious and if everything seems to be normal? You know, we probably think that these disorders arise through ordinary kind of psychological mechanisms like dissociation. So we all dissociate from time to time, which is just, you know, that your mind, your attention and your awareness wander away for a moment, especially when you're very distracted with lots of things. You can't pay attention to things. You can't take in information. That's a sort of an ordinary feature of dissociation. We think that these sort of psychological mechanisms that are there to protect us from being overloaded, to help us to sort of shut down sometimes when we need to shut down, that they become very exaggerated in people with psychosomatic or dissociative seizures. And that's what caused the seizure in those cases. And that's not measurable. When you test people in that state, everything looks normal.
So, you know, right now we're talking about EEG, electroencephalography, where you're actually looking at the waves of the brain, and you're saying that the sort of seizure activity doesn't look like what we think of as classic epileptic seizure activity. But earlier you mentioned if we look at an fMRI, for example, a functional magnetic resonance image, that their brains might be doing something that's more similar to a classic seizure, or at least that it doesn't look like they're, quote, faking it.
No, yeah. So their brain doesn't do something like a classic seizure, but it does something different to faking. So what we'll see in somebody who has a dissociative seizures is that we see that the connectivity, say, between the emotional part of the brain and the motor area of the brain, that there's much more sort of connectivity between those areas of the brain than there would be in someone who doesn't have a dissociative seizures. So you're seeing different patterns of motor activation, but you will see a different pattern in each of these groups. Someone who's faking a seizure will have one pattern. Someone who has dissociative or psychosomatic seizures has another pattern, and people with epilepsy have another pattern. So these three things are distinctly different.
And just to clarify, you know, in the psychological literature, obviously the long used terminology was conversion disorder. So this is a neurological symptom that is not intended to be produced. You know, it's not the same as what we mentioned, factitious disorder or malingering, but you know, measurable or observable neurological symptoms, maybe with no known cause or with a more psychological cause or just a complicated, poorly understood cause. In the neurological literature, you mentioned these dissociative seizures. I read quite often the term functional neurological syndrome. Do you find that seizures themselves are a more common manifestation of this type of like psychogenic illness, or do you see a lot of, you know, different types of manifestations?
I mean, if you can imagine a symptom now, it has manifest for psychosocial, psychosomatic reasons. So it pretty much is any symptom. So I speak as a neurologist and I see a lot of seizures, which is why I speak mostly about seizures. But if you go to a dermatology clinic, you'll see people with skin rashes. If you go to a gastroenterology clinic, stomach upsets, difficulty swallowing, and you know, any abdomen related disorder. So every single symptom you can imagine can arise in this way. And what the symptom is probably really depends on what triggers it. So I think we have a sort of idea that everything has to be triggered by stress, but actually often these things can be triggered by a change in our body that we don't understand. So for example, I would see people who have something like they get on a very packed train. It's rush hour. Back in the days when we had rush hour and people got on packed trains, they get on the train, they feel really dizzy, and they collapse, and it's a faint. So that's a completely normal thing. But what can happen is that's also a terrifying thing. And it can set off a chain reaction, which causes people to be frightened to get on the train, which activates their autonomic nervous system, their stress pathways, and produces a whole array of symptoms just when they're approaching the train. And then because they're worried about symptoms, they begin paying attention to their bodies in an unusually sort of vigilant way. And that sort of chain of events can lead to them ultimately having seizures and needing to come and see me. But if the trigger was different, let's say someone injured themselves at the gym and they hurt their back, then their trajectory of symptoms might be different because it started with a focus on their back. And similarly, you know, skin rashes, difficulty breathing, etc. You know, how they, any symptom can happen, and which symptom will happen probably depends on what was the first thing that happened to them to set the ball rolling.
Interesting. You know, I'm trying to put myself into the shoes of, you know, an individual who's struggling with one of these things. And I think I have a perfect example from my own experience in that when I probably in my late 20s, actually, it was more like my early 30s, started to experience migraine, but I don't experience migraine with pain. I have classic scintillating scotoma. I have a classic aura. I have the lightning bolt that starts in one corner of my vision and moves across, and they last about 20 minutes. And they're very textbook. And at first I thought I was having a stroke. And then I remembered reading Oliver Sacks's Migraine. And I was like, I think I know what this is. And I looked it up and it was like exactly what all of the GIFs online looked like. And I saw a neurologist and they were like, this is, you know, textbook visual migraine. And I was like, what's happening in my brain? And they were like, we don't really know, you know? And so there are, you know, different ideas of what could be happening. But the truth is, there's sort of no known cause. And when I keep a journal and a diary, and I think about what brings these on, and when are they more common, you know, lack of sleep, jet lag, severe stress, you know, it's one of these things where I'm having this neurological symptom that, you know, on paper and by measurement looks and tastes and acts like a classic neurological symptom. But the cause of this symptom is hard to put my finger on, hard for the experts to put their fingers on. And it can be induced by these lifestyle issues.
I mean, I always think migraine is a really interesting example, actually, not of a psychosomatic condition, but of a neurological condition, which for all the reasons you say is interesting because, you know, if I say to a patient, based on the story they tell me, and you've given me a classical story of migraine, I say, well, this story fits perfectly with migraine. I believe you have migraine. And obviously, I don't do a scan or anything because migraines don't show up on scans.
Exactly.
So people will generally say, well, you know, thanks, actually, I think it's migraine too. You know, how do I treat it? But if you have the exact same scenario with a psychosomatic condition, so somebody who's got pain that can't be explained, or in my case, seizures or paralysis or blindness, people struggle to accept the diagnosis because it doesn't show up on scans. And I think what it's kind of saying is that we hold these sorts of disorders to different standards than everything else. You know, if you go to your doctor, you know, when I qualified as a doctor, there was no test for Parkinson's disease. It was just diagnosed clinically. And people accepted a clinical diagnosis. They accepted that that's how we diagnose it. But psychosomatic disorders, people resist the clinical diagnosis because you haven't provided them with proof. And I think it's yet more evidence that the stigma we attach to these conditions means that people want so much more from their doctors when they're diagnosing it. And again, it's just another argument for reducing the stigma, I think.
I think you're right. And I think we see this often from the psychology and psychiatry side as well. Like, very often our diagnostic tools are simply, you know, they're psychological assessments. They're normed questions that tend to weigh heavily on certain symptoms that have been looked at. You know, they're very robust statistically, but ultimately they don't map to anything organic. And very often the reason that we know we're on the right trail when it comes to diagnostics has everything to do with response to medication and has almost nothing to do with any sort of, like, there's no reagent test. Like you said, there's no blood test for your, you know, serotonin levels. We can't do that. Maybe one day we'll be able to, but I have a feeling that even if those sort of organic tests become readily available, they're only going to complicate the issue further. They're not going to give us a clearer takeaway.
Yeah, I think as long as we've got a condition which people consider to be the fault of the individual affected. So I think if you tell someone, you know, you have a psychosomatic condition, that people will often think, you know, or you're saying it's my fault, or you're saying it's, I'm doing it on purpose. And also if you, you know, if you're having something very serious happen to you, like seizures or paralysis, and then you have to go and tell your boss or tell your neighbor what your diagnosis is, you know that a sizable proportion of people will kind of give you a bit of a wry eye, sort of, you know, like they'll see you a little bit differently because you're, you know, if they thought you had epilepsy, they're entirely sympathetic. But if they think it's psychosomatic, that immediately sort of downgrades your suffering for them. And so I think that people will always resist sort of the kind of this diagnosis. I mean, for this book, I traveled around the world visiting people, like a group of people in Kazakhstan who had a sleeping sickness, people in upstate New York who had tics, Tourette's, and seizure-like syndromes, South America, where 1,000 schoolgirls had seizures. And, you know, these and a bunch of other groups. And in each of these cases, the diagnosis of a psychosomatic or psychosocial cause for their illness was very, very clear. But in each of these cases, you know, for a variety of biological and other reasons, it was clear that what was happening to these communities was psychosocial. Every single one of these groups absolutely rejected that idea outright. And in each case, they preferred very much to go for some far-fetched explanation. So, for example, the case in upstate New York was, people may have heard of it. It happened about 2012. A group of girls in a high school in New York got Tourette's and then seizure-like symptoms. And their doctors diagnosed them with conversion disorder, an older name for psychosomatic or functional disorder. And then Aaron Brockovich, who's obviously famous for uncovering sort of scandals of chemical leaks and so forth, that got involved because the girls were so strongly against the diagnosis of a psychosomatic disorder. They felt that there must be something poisoning them. And Erin Brockovich got involved and said that she had uncovered a train crash that had leaked chemicals into the school. But this outbreak happened in 2012. The train crash happened in 1971. And, you know, that sort of, and for many, many other reasons, the possibility that this train crash could have caused these girls' sickness was just far-fetched, to say the least. But when faced with kind of news programs, people said things about these young women, like they called them the witches of Leroy, you know, kind of comparing them to sort of old kind of witch trials of old. And they said things that they were kind of mad or they were pretending or they came from poor families or they were psychologically disturbed. So when faced with those sort of accusations and those sort of attitudes, anybody would choose the 1971 train crash. We're forcing people into positions of having to choose far-fetched causes for their illnesses because we are attaching such terrible stereotypes and stigma to this very, very ordinary and common diagnosis.
And I guess that sort of raises the question because obviously not only are these these disorders, these syndromes, so often, as you note in your book, through your reporting and your traveling, culture bound, but the reaction to a disorder like this is also culture bound. And so it really, I guess, raises an important question that I think we should clarify. And one is that, do we know what is happening psychologically, neurologically, collectively to induce these symptoms? Or is the issue here that it's a disorder of no known cause? So is it a question of we actually understand pretty well the all of the sort of symptoms that are occurring at the same time, all of the precipitating factors, all of the stressors? Or is it that we're sort of putting these in as a diagnosis of exclusion? Like we ourselves as clinicians, as scientific investigators, still don't fully understand what's going on. And so the diagnosis becomes one of a psychogenic origin.
Yeah, it's super important that people understand that we, certainly as neurologists, don't make this as a diagnosis of exclusion. So it's not the diagnosis that I arrive at because I can't find anything else.
So it's not like what's historically been like IBS.
Well, no, I think IBS is linked. But again, these aren't, well, let's talk about the neurological conditions. So I don't wander too much into other people's areas. But let's say in the neurological conditions, I think a lot of people's perception is that I'm saying your problem is what we now call functional disorder or psychosomatic disorder. They think that I'm saying that because the test scan was normal, I couldn't find anything else. But actually, that's not it. It's very much what you were talking about when you mentioned your migraine earlier. We diagnose it on positive signs and positive symptoms. So, for example, the nervous system is arranged in a very precise way. So if you get a lesion of your brain or your spine or your muscle, it will produce a very particular pattern of muscle weakness and a very particular type of change in tone in your muscles, for example. So when neurologists are examining you, they're looking for those kind of patterns of muscle weakness, patterns of reflex change, etc., that help us to figure out, I can tell the difference by examining someone, if their lesion is in their spine or their lesion is in their brain or their lesion is in their muscle, by the pattern of weakness and the types of way the leg feels. And for functional disorders or psychosomatic disorders, there are patterns of weakness and patterns of symptoms that don't fit with neuroanatomy. So we're looking for those positive signs that say, you know, this does not make anatomical sense as a brain disease or a spinal cord disease, etc. It defies anatomy. So we're, again, like in the migraine, we're looking for positive signs of a functional or psychosomatic disorder rather than just looking for other things. And if we can't find them, saying it's that. So it's a diagnosis we make in exactly the same way. If I see someone, I think that they have Parkinson's disease, I'm looking for a particular kind of tremor, a particular kind of rigidity. I'm looking at the way they walk. I take all these clinical signs together and I say, you've got Parkinson's disease. Functional disorders are exactly like that. We're looking for the typical signs and symptoms. And any doctor who's making it as a diagnosis of exclusion is doing the wrong thing. That's not what it is. It's a diagnosis that's made based on typical clinical features like any other medical problem. I think people need to understand that. I think you asked me a lot more, but I've forgotten the rest of that, the point of that question.
I think that was the ultimate takeaway was, is this, so I was sort of, yeah, you're right. I was sort of contextualizing it within culture, which is a secondary thought, which I think we'll get into. But the idea here is that this is not a diagnosis of exclusion. This is a diagnosis that's based on the available evidence. It's a diagnosis that, is based on...
Just a typical clinical features, really. It's just like if you go to your doctor and you've got all of the right signs for symptoms for asthma, and then they listen to your chest and you've got a wheeze, they'll say you've got asthma. And again, functional disorders have a typical set of signs and symptoms that we're looking for to make the diagnosis, and it's not on a normal scan.
Yeah, I think that a lot of times this speaks to a sort of global misunderstanding of the way that clinical diagnostics sort of happens. And I think we've seen throughout the COVID pandemic that this sort of like common knowledge has been tested quite a bit. Like as a culture, at least here in the West, at least here in America, which is where I can sort of only speak to, there's a comfort that comes from a reagent test. There's a comfort that comes from a diagnostic lab test where you can put a drop of blood or a swab of spit or a scrape of your nasal epithelium onto a little plate, and then you hear back from a lab, it's positive or it's negative. And I think that what that doesn't go to show is exactly how those tests were developed, exactly what these individuals are looking for. You know, even the conversation around if you've been vaccinated versus if you haven't been vaccinated and you can still spread the disease, or how likely are you to catch the disease, that it's all an order of concentration. Like, we're talking about viral load, we're talking about sort of thresholds and cutoffs, but very often I think we as a culture want to think that it's binary, either like, yes, I have a virus, or no, I don't, when really it's how much of a viral load do I have? And at what point does it become clinically meaningful? And that's, I think, a very hard thing for a lot of people to wrap their heads around.
Yeah, I mean, you started by saying, you know, people get comfort, and I'm terrified that what I'm going to say next is going to steal a little bit of that comfort away from them, but I fear it is. But, you know, this is the problem. So I'm traveling around the world and I'm visiting communities that, you know, explain illnesses in different ways. Like, some people have more spiritual causes, or some people, you know, blame government conspiracies, and that depended on their society. But then you had to ask yourself, well, you know, if I've gone to Kazakhstan and I've kind of theorized about their social influences, and I've gone to South America and theorized about their social influences, what are our, you know, culture band syndromes, you know, us who subscribe to Western medicine? Because we don't really believe we have culture-bound symptoms, but of course, of syndromes. We don't believe we have disorders that only exist in a time and a place because of our current cultural and societal beliefs. But unfortunately, of course we do. It's just very hard to see them because we're living in this time. But, you know, if you look at the way we define disease, we probably are a society that, or we definitely are, a society that medicalizes and overdiagnoses at a very high rate. I think a lot of people think that, you know, as you say, they have a blood test and the blood test is positive and that's a definite thing. But actually, quite a large number of tests and quite a large number of medical diagnoses are made based on arbitrary cutoff points made by a small group of medical doctors who all have very strong kind of cultural and societal influences help, you know. So for example, you know, what's a normal weight, for example? Well, in Los Angeles, overweight is a completely different thing than overweight in Samoa or overweight in the north of England. You know, that's just an example, just for people to kind of try simplify a little what I'm saying. But when we're deciding what renal failure is, or what high blood pressure is, or what ADHD is, or what depression is, we are arbitrarily placing parameters on those things. And Western medicine demands that we doctors don't miss anything. So we will always, when we're placing parameters on diagnosis, make it so inclusive that we'll include a few extra people who don't have the problem in our group, rather than risk missing out on people. So I think that sort of, you know, if we want to know what our sort of culture balance syndrome, what I think will change in the future, is that we will move away from heavily medicalizing every change. You know, recently, I'm sure you're aware, grief has been placed into the DSM, which makes it a medical illness. Now, I can see the reason for that, because once you classify something as an illness, you know, you're covered by insurance, you fit in a system so you know what doctor to go to. It's easier to sort of take time off work, etc. So there's lots of advantages to medicalizing something like that. But I'm not sure that it's always the right thing either, because once you medicalize something, it can become a chronic problem. It encourages the symptoms to continue by giving it a label.
You know, I agree. I miss the days of the V codes and the old DSM-4. I think one of the things that I struggle with in my sort of academic approach, and then comparing that or sort of squaring that with my clinical approach to patient care, is that from a psychological perspective, I identify as somebody who is oriented in the sort of existential humanistic tradition of psychotherapy. So I pick and choose which CBT and sort of psychodynamic approaches to psychotherapy I'm comfortable with. So, you know, I'm not classically Freudian. I'm not classically behavioristic or cognitive and behavioristic in my approach. And in that, so this is going to be a long drawn out way for me to say that I'm constantly struggling with the very sort of evidence-based, skeptic, you know, science-based, almost logical positivistic side of myself, which is like, we want to test, and we want to look at the available evidence, and we want to always make decisions based on the best available evidence, and the much more sort of postmodern, much more, there's a word that I'm losing right now because I'm still not fully caffeinated yet, but the much more sort of patient-focused view of care. And there are these big debates in the DSM, right? It's always going back and forth between these big debates that are, am I more dimensional in my diagnostic sort of sensibilities, or am I more categorical? Categorical meaning like, these are the cutoffs, this is the category, do you qualify based on X, Y, and Z criteria? If so, you have the disorder, if not, you don't. And my view is much more dimensional. We're all sort of somewhere on a spectrum. At what point does it become meaningful, right? At what point does it interfere with our ability to do our activities of daily living? And if it interferes, we call it a disorder. We call it a syndrome. If it doesn't interfere, it's sort of, you know, who you are. It's sort of how you live and exist in the world. But I run into problems sometimes when working with psychiatrists because I don't medicate. It's very easy for me to say, oh, I have this very dimensional view because I do therapy. I work with people, I meet them where they're at, and we talk through their issues, and I can really, really contextualize everything for them. But a psychiatrist doesn't necessarily have that luxury. A psychiatrist may need to pick a drug and prescribe that drug, and they need to be damn careful if this person qualifies medically for that drug. And that's a very different problem to face.
I mean, I'm 100% like-minded with you on this. You know, I feel like all of this sort of labeling and categorizing people is not necessarily a good thing. I think it is a good thing for people at the severe ends of spectrums where, you know, it's obvious, you know, that this is a significant disabling problem.
Right. Paranoid schizophrenia, severe bipolar disorder, things where like, if you're not on your meds, it's very problematic for you to get through your day. And yeah, we need to actually, in some ways, medicalizing them helps the system keep you from falling through the cracks.
Absolutely. And even severe depression. But if you get to the milder end of the depression scale, you know, I think it's very easy now to acquire a label like depression. And, you know, there's a short-term gain in being given a label because it sort of explains your suffering to yourself and to others. And it comes with a sort of a line of treatment that's sort of detailed in medical literature, etc. But I think people don't fully understand that once you take on a medical label, it can be very hard to shake it again. And you become a person who suffers with depression, you know, whereas, and I often read in literature, people saying things like, you know, this particular community who are don't subscribe so much to Western medicine, they're underdiagnosed with depression. But actually, when you look closer at those communities, you find actually what they do is they don't consider depression to be an illness, they consider it to be situational. And I think that may be a healthier way of looking at things because it means it's something that you're suffering with that if you make changes to your life, you can potentially get better from without necessarily becoming chronic. But you're right also about, you know, I speak from a position of luxury also. I don't get quite as much time with my patients as you do, but I, you know, as someone who does more sort of analysis type work does, but I don't have as little time as a lot of doctors. You know, a lot of doctors get such a tiny amount of time with their patient that to try and contextualize their problem is so difficult. You know, so I do realize that I'm very much trying to say we need to have a psychosocial view of these disorders and understand the context in which they're occurring. But I also appreciate that what I'm suggesting is not practically easy for a lot of people.
Well, and it almost seems like what you're suggesting, and tell me if I'm wrong, is a more a new, maybe it's not even new, because I think it harkens back to a lot of other cultures and a lot of historical periods, but an evolving epidemiological view, an evolving clinical view. So it's not just about one physician and or one clinician and their patient. It's about how do we as a society and as a field approach these syndromes and these disorders, and seeing a change in that way that, because I've seen this quite a lot with some of my dear friends who will sort of come to me and say, hey, I don't know. I'm thinking maybe it's ADHD, maybe it's anxiety. Is there a test I can take? And I'm like, yes, but I've got to tell you, like, they don't tell us much. Or recently I had a friend who asked me, you know, I've been going to this clinic and I think that they want to help me with this anxiety problem. And I was like, well, you understand that if you're going to an anxiety clinic, they're going to see anxiety. And that's not to say that if somebody doesn't have a scrap of anxiety and they go to an anxiety clinic, that a very good clinician would say, like, I don't think you need to be here. But of course, if somebody's whole career is focused on treating a very specific syndrome, no matter where you fall on the spectrum, they're going to conceptualize you in terms of that syndrome and start working on how to treat that syndrome. And I think that's sort of an example of this fundamental problem, is that we are not a collection of symptoms. We are people. And as people, you know, we all have our varying ways that we exist in the world. And sometimes we need help with problems. And that's sort of how I've always conceptualized therapy. Like, I see multi-chronic and like multi-comorbidity in my patients, because I see patients who are specifically seeing me because they have cancer. And so I'm doing therapy for patients with cancer. Some of them are first diagnosis. Some of them are, you know, living with the disease. Some of them are in survivorship, and some of them are dying of the disease. But they also have lost loved ones to COVID. They also are dealing with this global phenomenon, which is COVID, which I think everybody should be diagnosed with, like, COVID stress, you know, like every time I see somebody, it's like, yep, that's what's happening in the world right now. And then they have their other issues, depression, anxiety, you know, maybe sometimes even severe mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar. And you look at all those things together. And I think some people's approach is, what do I treat first? And other people's approach, which is more similar to mine, is, as a person, what is making it hard for you to get through your day? And how can we work on that?
Yeah, I mean, I very much feel that, like, everything is biopsychosocial. And, like, you know, cancer is a very good example, because, I mean, cancer is a serious physical illness, but it has huge psychological consequences, but also huge social consequences. And I guess that maybe 50 years ago, probably cancer was just treated as a physical problem. I doubt people had the luxury of seeing psychologists or having social workers, et cetera, in the past.
Oh, even today, most people don't have that.
Yeah, true. And I think we need to apply that approach to everything. So, you know, every team should have psychologists and social workers, whether the problem is, if it's cancer, you know, the sort of proportions of this, of these different problems will be different to someone who has a psychosomatic problem, where the loads of physical symptoms, but maybe even bigger psychological issues, you know. But every single thing has a biological, psychological, and a social problem, kind of element to it. And I think that's really what we need to do, is take a biopsychosocial approach to everything. And maybe that would solve a little bit of the stigma as well. If everybody has this same sort of team addressing these three elements, then it wouldn't be like it is now, which is, oh, you're not suited to a neurologist, so I'm going to send you to a psychiatrist. It's like you've been dismissed from the neurologist's office and sent elsewhere.
Oh, right, like demoted. Yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, I was tempted for a moment to say demoted, but then I thought, well, all of my psychiatry colleagues will be throwing rotten tomatoes at me.
Well, exactly, because the issue is that it's not a demotion, but you're right, like, culturally we view it as such. And so I guess then the main question really is, how do we get to that place, given, and And I know that things are quite different in the UK than they are here in the US with regards to managed care, because we don't have the luxury of a national health system at the same time, or a national health service at the same time. There are some things that, you know, in the UK, there's not a luxury of. I know that mental health care treatment, for example, is a struggle there. It is here too, but for different reasons. And so the question is, you know, I'm constantly struggling with this as a sort of, I'm about to be a PhD candidate. So I'm still not even, you know, I still don't have the doctorate, and I'm definitely not licensed. And I'm the only psych person, I say in quotes, because I'm not a psychologist yet, in my division at the hospital where I work. It's all social workers. And there's one MFT, a marriage and family therapist, so a master's level psychotherapist, and then myself. And they're really, psychology at my hospital is not robust. It's mostly neuropsychology. So it's in, you know, physical medicine and rehab. And I'm like constantly talking to people. I have a lot of friends who work in healthcare. And it's like, oh, you could use a psychologist. And they're always like, oh, we need one of you. Oh, it'd be great if you were over here on this service. Oh, I, you know, I have to have a hard conversation with the family talking about going off life support. I wish I had a psychologist. And it's like, yeah, I wish that psychologists were plugged in all over, or at least, I shouldn't say at least, but, or more robustly, mental health as a whole, whether it be social work, whether it be MFTs, you know, different therapists. How do we get to a place where mental health is a sort of equal part of the team as traditional, quote, medical intervention?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really difficult problem. I mean, I think the first thing is, obviously, we need to change the way we think about these disorders, because I think there's quite a lot of, there's still a lot of dualism around. I think people pay lip service to, you know, there's a lot of, you know, celebrity says they're depressed and everyone says, oh, depression is a very serious illness. And people are kind of saying, you know, that these things are just as serious as other things. But, or they say that, you know, the mind is a function of the brain and therefore we should consider them together. There's big talk, but then you look at services and exactly as you've described, there'll be like, you know, we've got 100 neurologists working in the hospital that I work in, but, you know, we've got a, I've got a tiny handful of psychiatrists or psychologists that I can refer my patients to. These should be equal numbers. So I think, you know, we're great at talking big about saying that, you know, psychological matters, subjects, issues matter. But I think we really need to destigmatize these conditions and put, you know, those words into action. But I think one of the big problems is a practical thing, both is for different reasons in the US and the UK, which is it's actually quite hard to show a hospital that they'll earn money from these things. You know, if you tried to commission services saying that, you know, I think that my patients' lives would be greatly improved by having greater psychological input, you know, the first thing I'm asked is, you know, how much money will that bring in and how will they pay for themselves? And I'm sure it's the same in the US with insurance companies don't pay for things that haven't been sort of shown as working in evidence-based trials and so forth. So I
And even still then, how do they define working? You're right. Like, I think especially on a consultation liaison kind of basis, like somebody just has a diagnosis and having a mental health care provider present to help them understand their diagnosis and plan for their treatment is a completely different conversation than billable, you know, 60-minute psychotherapy sessions.
Yeah, well, that's it. And I think we do need to work on the health economics of this in order to, because, you know, we do work in a live in a practical world, don't we? So we, you know, we have to appreciate that things cost money, and we do have to sort of find better ways of demonstrating how these treatments work and of the benefit of them. Or else, I don't think we're ever going to convince health services and insurers to pay for them.
You're so right. I think about restaurants, and I'm not sure exactly how it works in the UK because tipping is not as expected, right? But here in the US, like basically the wait staff makes below a living wage. And so it's sort of expected that you're always going to tip at least 20% on your bill. And then the wait staff usually walks away with that 20% in their pocket. But there are other restaurants where they have a more sort of, dare I say, socialist view, where when you tip, the tips get pooled, and then a certain percentage goes to the bussers, a certain percentage goes to the dishwashers, a certain percentage goes to front of house, to back of house. And I'm wondering if that wouldn't make more sense from a healthcare perspective, that sort of like the billing gets sort of spread out based on all of the different components of an individual's care, as opposed to each specialty billing specifically with FaceTime. Because we're seeing that now with telehealth too, where right now there's sort of a caveat because of COVID, but we're already starting to see in the hospitals that more and more people are needing to go back in face to face because we can't get those facility fees and we can't get all of the ways that we were used to billing. And just the way we bill is not conducive to patient treatment. It's conducive to getting people paid.
Yeah. And it's sort of, you know, if you're being paid for the scans you do, it increases sort of overdiagnosis and overtesting. I think there's a sort of an overhaul to be had on the way that we pay for things, because it undervalues things like psychological support, which I think would be, my patients do not need more scans. You know, they don't need more blood tests. They don't need more scans. They need more psychological and social support most of the time. But you know what? I don't have it for them a lot of the time, which is a terrible shame.
Yeah, the system doesn't allow for it. What so often, you know, I just ended treatment with quite a few patients. And one of the things that I noticed is that, so I'm a no charge because I'm a student. So there was this sort of like bonus of my patients not needing to pay for mental health while I was working with them. And when we terminated and I started to look for resources within their own community, some of them were like, well, it needs to be under my insurance. And I'm like, well, we're not going to find you somebody with cancer experience under your insurance. It just doesn't exist. Like, unfortunately, I don't want to say the best because this is not true at all, but the bulk of psychotherapists in our country have realized that they don't need to work through managed care. They can make more money not working with insurers, being out of network and saying, here's a super bill. You can try to put it through your insurance. Maybe you'll get a reimbursement on something, but ultimately you just need to pay me up front. It's easier for me. I don't have to pay for an insurance specialist, and I can command these rates because there aren't enough of us. And it's like you said, the incentivization is really off. Like you see with psychiatry, for example, so many psychiatrists that I know are like, I wish I could spend an hour with each patient, but I would make the same if I spent an hour with them as if I spent 20 minutes with them. I get paid per patient. And yes, there's an algorithm for how many minutes we spend, but it's more conducive to a living wage if I see more patients. And seeing more patients means spending less time with each one. And that shouldn't be the algorithm.
Exactly. I once, in order to try and justify this sort of argument of needing more kind of psychological support for my patients, tried to estimate, you know, if I could stop my patients' drugs, and which I thought I could if I had someone to support them through it, you know, could I kind of claw the money back? And you know what? The drugs cost some ridiculous amount of money, like $10 a month or something. Drugs are cheap. Sort of actual employing people isn't cheap. But until we sort of start getting that health economics worked out a bit better, everyone's going to be shortchanged.
You're so right. And I think a lot of it does go down to preventive care, and it goes down to early intervention. You see these incredible outcomes from, you know, mindfulness intervention programs that are instituted at the elementary school level, where little children are learning emotion regulation, little tiny children are learning, you know, basic mental health skills that it takes years to teach once we've sort of laid down our neural architecture in a way that doesn't promote this kind of healthful living. And I think one of the ways that we can sort of save money on the back end is to do more of this stuff up front when it's relatively cheap and easy. But it takes a certain amount of trust. It takes a certain amount of it takes a lack of cynicism, you know, to say we want to introduce a mindfulness program for our kindergartners. You know, some people go, I don't need that shit for my kid. And that's where the problem really lies, right? Like, we've got to change public opinion about this. And it's not just about, oh, it's a nice frou-frou hippie thing that we should all be doing because it'll make the, you know, kumbaya, the world go round better. It's like, no. This is actually has positive health outcomes for decades.
Yeah. I mean, very much so. And it's sort of in sort of thinking and visiting different communities who had different sort of illnesses and things, what was clear is that, you know, we learn our sort of models about how to interpret what's happening to our bodies, how to respond what's happening to our bodies or to what's happening in our social environment. We learn that at a very young age, and then our brains play out those patterns. And unfortunately, I fear we're doing the exact opposite of what you just said, which is we're not teaching our children to sort of, have a healthier approach to things so they won't develop psychological or psychosomatic problems later. We're actually giving them labels that say they're abnormal in school. We're increasingly saying to people, well, you've got this kind of learning problem and you've got that kind of learning problem, because that's, again, a way of attracting money and getting support, when probably we should be recognizing when someone's struggling and not giving it a label, but teaching them methods for coping without giving them a diagnosis they'll live with for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely. And I can tell you, so often I'm lucky enough in the clinic where I work that the quote diagnosis that I can often put are things like psychosocial distress or anxiety associated with the dying process. These are like ICD-9 labels that don't really map to the DSM, but that I'm allowed to do because they're there for a, you know, quote, medical reason for cancer. But what I would love to be able to do is diagnose strengths-based, because that's really what my model for therapy is. Where are our strengths? What are the things that have helped serve us? How can we maximize those? I often use the poker analogy. I don't know if you're a poker player, but for anybody listening who is, you know, the best way in the long run to do well when you play poker, because you cannot control the cards you catch, is to maximize your wins and minimize your losses. And in the end, that's an algorithm for success. And that's sort of always been the approach that I take with mental health. Where do we have strengths? How do we maximize them? Where are our deficits and our weaknesses and our difficulties? How can we minimize their impact in our life? And collectively, we'll get through this together. Suzanne, I'm hoping that this has been such a fascinating chat, and I've learned so much, and I'm like really excited for all the other stories in your book. Before we go, because I know we're a couple minutes over, I'm hoping that I can ask you to maybe stay and answer the final two questions that I ask everybody who comes on my show. Because
sure.
Oh yay. Okay, good. So these are sort of big picture questions. So I want you to sort of expand.
I'm terrified now.
I know, right?
I'm absolutely terrified. If I suddenly hang up, I'll pretend it's the internet connection.
I always feel so bad. I've actually had people write to me and be like, Carrie, you sound so apologetic at the end of the show when you ask them. I'm like, I know I'm putting them on the spot. Okay, so, and also contextualize them however feels relevant to you. So it could have to do with like the book. It could have to do with your work as a neurologist. It could have to do with your own personal experience. It could be global. It could be cosmic. Whatever the context you like. The first question is, what is the thing that's really keeping you up at night? The thing you're concerned about, worried, maybe pessimistic, even borderline cynical about? And then on the flip side, so we end on a more, you know, uplifting note, where are you finding genuine hope, optimism in your life right now? What are you truly looking forward to?
Oh my God, they are such difficult questions. It's so difficult. Okay, if I think the thing that really worries me is the way that we are, it's really what I said, the very last thing we said in our discussion, which is the way we are now labeling children with mental disorders with such absolute enthusiasm. And I understand why people do it, because there was an era, I'm sure when I was in school, that this happened, where a child who was struggling was just ignored, and the people who could have got a bit of extra help could have just done so much more with their lives if someone had recognized it. So now we're trying to correct that by explaining why people are struggling so that we can justify the help. And I'm so worried for a future generation of people who've been told at the age of 16 that they're depressed or they have a learning problem, when really all it was that they needed a bit of extra help and that they were struggling, and now they're suddenly, you know, got labels that they might never shake. So I would absolutely love for us to learn a way of sort of recognizing people who need help without having to kind of pathologize them to give them that help. So that's really what worries me most. What am I most looking forward to? Listen, the end of the pandemic. When can I hop on a plane and go to, when I was writing this book, I visited, as I said, the mosquito people in Texas, and I did a road trip around Texas. And I am longing for at this moment is to do more US road trips. There's nothing I enjoy more than holidaying and traveling. And I feel that the end of the pandemic is coming and that we have exciting freedom ahead that we can appreciate fully for the first time in a long time.
Oh my goodness. I am so, so with you here, here. Everybody, the book is The Sleeping Beauties and Other Stories of Mystery Illness by Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan. Thank you so much for being here. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.